back to my garden, episode 44.
Welcome to Back to My Garden. Discover your passion for gardening. Here's Dave Ledoux.
Are you concerned about toxic chemicals, GMOs, and frankenfood? Don't panic, grow organic. Discover my new resource for organic gardening for free at www.backtomygarden.com/myorganic. Do you love homegrown tomatoes? Free report reveals the 5 dirt cheap tools I use to grow 22 types of heirloom tomatoes, including my secret soil booster. Download your copy instantly for free today at www.backtomygarden.com/free report. Well, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are in the world when you listen to this. I'm Dave Ledoux, and welcome to another edition of Back to My Garden. And for those of you just joining us, we've been chatting for minutes about great stuff, and I didn't hit the record button. So welcome to another awesome podcast. My guest today is from the East Coast of the United States. Michelle's from Frederick, Maryland. She's a freelance writer, a passionate dirt nerd, a child herder, an unremorseful eater, and a wonderful cook. She has a gorgeous blog at plowandfurrow.com. We're going to talk about that in great detail. And she loves exploring outdoor living, conservation, and sustainability. So without any further ado, let's welcome to the show Michelle Donahue. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Dave.
Glad you could join us.
Thank you for having me.
I gave you a little brief intro, but I want to hear your story, and I'm sure our listeners want to get to know you a little better. Michelle, take a minute or two and tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into gardening.
Well, it's a little bit roundabout. I'm sure many people probably come to it in a similar way through my mother. She has always had something going. My dad was in the military, so we moved around a lot. About every 4 years, we'd have a new place, and every time we had a new place, she'd set to work after the house was unpacked to start scratching around, and she'd be digging out beds to plant marigolds and lobelias and vegetables. And we were in Germany for about 10 years, and she actually managed to grow the most amazing tomatoes. Even in the cold, damp climate of Germany, she was able to just bring this amazing bounty out of nothing. So I grew up watching that, and later in my adult life, I was between jobs, and a friend asked if I needed a job, and I said yes. He's like, well, talk to my neighbors, and they were running a native plant nursery in Virginia, and they said, well, do you know anything about plants? And I was like, well, a little bit. And they said, do you know the difference between a woody and a perennial? I was like, not really. And they said, great, we'll teach you everything. So it's kind of just been downhill from there.
You came into it as a blank canvas.
Totally blank, yep.
Wonderful. For those of you driving in your cars in rush hour traffic, Michelle and I send you our sympathies and we're thinking of you. Keep both hands on the wheel. I'm going to put all the links, all the resources in the show notes at the blog at Back to My Garden. Make sure when you get in front of a computer, you follow Michelle on Twitter at MZ Donahue, MZDonahue. Notice how I didn't say Z. I covered up my Canadianism. But your blog is extraordinary. It's www.plowandfurrow.com, and that's PlughAndFurrow. And you also have a WordPress blog for some of your writing, right?
Yes, it's a little more focused on some of my conservation sustainability interests. I don't update it as often, but there's a lot of stuff there that I feel like I've had a real privilege to be able to look into. It's called Green as Grass, because I'm terrible at coming up with these kinds of names, but it's at michelledonahue.wordpress.com.
Wonderful. Hey, maybe we'll start with your sustainability, because you have kids, you're a mom. The pace of change is just extraordinary. Talk to us a little bit about your efforts and philosophies on conservation and sustainability.
Well, you know, it's a big job, and I feel like my main approach to it is that if we all do something, you know, we're like ants. If we all carry a little bit of our burden, then it makes everyone's burden a little bit lighter. And so here at home, you know, I try and teach my kids where things come from and where they go. And, you know, the garden has a lot to do with that, where they can see where some of their food comes from. And so they make a greater connection with, you know, the resources it takes and the time and the effort. So It helps to have a green patch in the back to show the kids where some of that stuff happens.
Chatting with a friend of mine, and he's got a 13-year-old teenager. And the kid thought cheese came from the store in plastic uniform sheets.
Oh, no.
And he realized, my kid's never seen a cow.
Oh, no.
And so, you know, just that philosophy.
Yeah, well, we actually moved up here from Washington, D.C., which is very, as you know, dense and urban. And when my son was starting to get a little bit older, you know, we were outgrowing our apartment. So we started looking a little bit further afield because the way I grew up, again, in Germany and, you know, some very rural areas, like we had a lot of freedom. We had a lot of just exposure to natural resources. And I wanted my son and now my daughter to have a similar upbringing, you know, where they can, where they're not just restricted to sidewalks and, you know, city parks and things, but they can actually roam and wander and run. So that was a big reason for getting out of the city. And, you know, cities are doing wonderful things with urban gardens and rooftop farming and just reclaiming these empty lots. And I hope that spreads to every city, you know, in, if not in America, then in the world. I think it's fantastic what people are doing, just trying to take back blight to make it productive.
Wonderful. I would be remiss if we didn't bring pollinators into the conversation. What's the bee population like in Maryland? Is it part of the consciousness or is it not doing too badly?
The bee population, you know, I'm not a bee scientist. I can say that in my own yard, I've seen plenty of them. We don't use fertilizers or pesticides or anything like that, weed killers. So we have a lot of clover in our yard and I see them, you know, out and about in the yard. So I really can't say. We do have a lot of local honey producers and it doesn't seem like there's been any shortage. So I don't know if that issue is here so much, but I mean, I'm definitely aware of it in terms of like the industrial bee complex where their, you know, beehives are being shipped around to pollinate orchards and things like that. So, excuse me, my son just interrupted.
Tell him to go weed.
Yes. Yeah. No, but, you know, pollinators, I think the focus on bees is really good, but I'm also concerned that, well, I hope it opens up a greater discussion to pollinators in general, you know, not just honeybees, but all the other insects that do so much hard work that we just don't see. And, you know, it's one of the big reasons why I don't use chemicals, because I love to see it, number one. And I love to know that they're doing their jobs and that they can move on from here and go to my neighbors and go to, you know, their neighbors and just continue this chain of function. And to know that I have a part in helping maintain that, it really gives me a great sense of satisfaction. Mm.
You know, as a kid, if you had clover in your lawn, my neighbor who was from Europe, he had about 8 kinds of poison. And he would think nothing of just being out in the lawn, spraying poison on the clover in the lawn.
Yeah, I mean, our neighbors, they use Roundup in the cracks. And every time, you know, they all come over. They want to see what's going on in the yard. Like, I just planted up the north side of my house. It was this wasteland, awful. And they all come over to see what's going on with the new planting or what's happening in the garden. And they're like, how do you get your tomatoes so big? And I take those opportunities to try and say, well, this is what I do. But at the same time, they still have a lot to offer. You know, our neighbors to one side have been here for something like 35 years, and they'll tell us about resources, mushroom compost. Mm. We go up to Pennsylvania and it's the used up substrate in these mushroom houses. So it's this mix of things. And you come and you can get like a metric ton or a yard of it or something, and it's cheap. You bring it home, you put it in your garden, and everything just goes nuts. So if you don't have a ready source of compost, that's one thing. But anyway, my neighbors told me about that, and I had no idea. So, you know, chemicals or no, it's all like a learning process, and you go step by step.
Nice. Well, let's continue in that vein, because you and I share a love of heirlooms, especially tomatoes.
Yes.
What's your garden like this year?
My garden, actually, the tomatoes haven't been doing so great. It's been a lot cooler and a lot, we've had a lot of rain. Normally August, we don't get any rain. So I'd like to send some to California. Poor guys out there. I don't even know how they do it, but they're not 10 feet tall like normal, but we're still getting a lot of tomatoes. And our favorites that we always grow Cherokee Purple. Slow but worth the wait. And my dad is freaked out by the purple color. He will not touch them. We try and convince him, but he just won't. If it's not red, it's not a tomato. So we grow that. We grow Amish Paste. Green Zebra is another good one. And this year I tried a yellow one called Gena Lee. It's D-J-E-N-A. Nice. And that was makes for a beautiful plate when you cut them all up together.
I love the purple ones. We have bets with people who don't know and say, bet me what color you think it is in the middle. Oh, they'll say it's blue or it's pink. And then when they get to cut it, it's almost, it's just red inside.
It's just
red. But it tastes delicious.
Yeah.
And the polar vortex must be getting you then with the damp, cool summer.
Yeah, it persists. You know, I was really worried we had really cold temperatures this March, and I wondered, is winter ever going to end? Canada, keep your cold air. Mm-hmm. But it's been a nice summer. Everyone says it's been perfect, but I worry about what that means for this winter. So I'm enjoying it, but kind of trying not to be too doom and gloom about what's coming.
I tell people, anytime you feel bad about the weather, think of the poor people in Buffalo, New York with 9 feet of snow.
No.
Yeah, they just get pounded last winter.
Yep. And apparently the winter that we had this past year was more typical of winters historically. So rather than nice, dry, mild winters, they've usually been very wet, very cold. You know, the Chesapeake Bay is not far from here, and it never freezes. It never gets cold enough. And this year, the bay froze over. Wow. So it was quite a winter.
So you plant in the spring, what, in mid-May?
I try and get things in the ground as early as possible. When I see things starting to come up, and it's usually mid-March, the earliest things start popping up, I will try and get radishes in. I will do, what else do I put out in the spring? I've tried beets early, but those didn't do too well. Peas are another big one that I put out early. And again, this year it was so cold that a lot of things just didn't do too well. So I definitely went too early this year, but mid-April is definitely safe here.
Yeah, in March, the first sunny day, you always can tell a gardener. He's out in his backyard shoveling 2 feet of snow off the garden.
Yep.
Delusional, thinking, nearly ready.
Trying to get it warmed up. But really, for me, like my gardening season doesn't start. I don't wait until it warms up. I start a lot of my own things inside. I've got this little rickety apparatus inside with some fluorescent lights I found on the side of the road and like a seedling heat mat. So I'll start onions, I start celery, I do all my tomatoes myself.
Tell me more about this wonderful contraption you found.
Well, it's a homemade rig. It's, you've seen plant rack stands. Mm-hmm. So it's basically just a four shelf system with two of the shelves have fluorescent lights on it with little pulleys so I can adjust the height of the lights. One of them has a heat mat underneath of it for starting the seeds. And then once they are up, I will take them off the heat and then just raise the lights as they grow. Hmm.
Love it. Repurposed, functional.
Yep. That's what we try to do. We use lots of strawberry containers for little mini greenhouses this year. And I started all my basil in those, started my onions in those. So that's really nice. You can just take the top on and off for humidity and stuff like that.
Can I tell you my confessional about heat lamps?
Please.
My wife was angry this spring because all of her seedlings are spindly and leggy. And she says, I think our lights need to be replaced. Me, the expert, I said, I'm the husband. You don't need new lights. Those lights are perfectly fine. When I was a kid, we didn't have lights. We had darks. And she said, I think we need new lights. And so I caved and we got new lights. And immediate. Brand new lights. The seedlings were just loving it.
You have fluorescent tubes?
Yeah, fluorescent tubes.
It's amazing because they look fine to our eye, but the plants can tell the difference in the spectrum.
I'll suggest to all the married men out there, happy wife, happy life.
And yes.
When they want new lights, give them new lights because you're going to be the ultimate beneficiary in the fall when you eat.
Well, my big purchase for this year that I'm really looking forward to trying out next year, big purchase, all of $10, is a little fan. I have also had trouble with spindly plants, even with new lights, you know, because the indoor temperature is really not ideal for starting plants. They like it a little bit cooler, warm during the day, cool at night. And one thing that I read, and my husband makes fun of me, is when you have little tomatoes, to make them nice and stocky and thick so they're strong for setting out, you're supposed to pet them. So you brush your hands over the tops of the tomatoes. And what that does is it activates this like enzyme inside the cell walls, and it actually stiffens them up. And one thing that we don't have inside that plants are constantly exposed to outside is wind. So you have this motion that they're always, you know, competing with, and without that inside. So I bought a fan to try and replicate, like to give them some breezes. You know, even in commercial greenhouses, there's always a fan going. So we'll see how that does with my little seedlings this year. Maybe I won't be petting my tomatoes as much. I have a fan on them.
Michelle, that was wisdom right there. I always write down notes so my listeners don't have to. They get the benefits of it. So the two secrets to tomato seedlings to make them flourish. A fan? Is it an oscillating fan?
No, it's just a little, I think it's even battery operated. I don't know if it's plug-in. Oscillating would be better because that way it's not constant, you know.
And the petting. I've never heard that.
The petting, yep, petting tomatoes.
I have a feeling that may be my assignment next spring.
No, I always come in and just give them a little brush.
Nice.
And I like to mist them. I used to work for a native plant nursery in Alexandria, as I mentioned before, in Virginia. And my boss, we would do a lot of propagation. So we did cuttings and we would try and root things out. And when plants don't have many roots, you have to mist them because they actually absorb water through their foliage. And my boss, Carla, would always say, mist is plant delight. So every time I'm squeezing a water bottle over my little seedlings in the dead of winter, I'm like, mist is plant delight.
Nice. A lot of people are digging this because, oh no, I didn't mean that. That's a pun. A lot of people are enjoying this because we have a lot of urban gardeners who garden in containers.
Yes.
And so, you know, you leave for work at 6:30 in the morning, you drive through rush hour and you get home at 7 at night. So you need low maintenance, hardy plants. Mm-hmm. And these will help, these ideas. It's good stuff.
Yeah, and I think there's been, you know, because there's been so much of an interest in urban gardening, I think you see more and more varieties that are selected for container growing. You got the small tomatoes, and you see a lot of articles about growing lettuce and even doing deeper containers for carrots and potatoes and things like that. So you can definitely, you don't have to stick to the old standbys of herbs. You can grow vegetables in containers.
This season in your garden, what are you most proud of and what has frustrated you?
In my vegetable garden?
Yeah, at home. Whatever comes to mind.
What am I most proud of? I have the most beautiful pole beans this year. I had this whole crop of volunteer sunflowers. Have you ever heard the term bird feeder flower?
No.
You plant sunflowers once and they basically drop seed and keep coming back. So they're feeding the birds. I've got goldfinches all over them. Mm. But they drop seed and they pop up, you know, new sunflowers the next year. So we set up these beautiful, very rustic bean poles from a bunch of branches broke off. We have this lovely red maple in our backyard and it got wrecked by an ice storm this winter. So we chopped up what we could and salvaged the rest and made bean poles out of the longer stems, thinking, I'll have these nice little bean poles and my beans will climb up. Well, about half the beans climbed up the poles and the rest of the beans climbed up the sunflower. So it looks very, I didn't do it on purpose, but I mean, it's a great effect.
Love.
So I think that's pretty neat. I really can't take credit for that though. The beans did that all by themselves. But in other parts of my yard, as I mentioned before, I've got a north side landscaping project that I just finished. And the problem with the side of my house, as a northern exposure, it's always cold in the winter. It gets battered by wind in the winter. In the summertime, it really only gets light in the morning and the afternoon. So that your plant list is pretty short for things you can pick from already. But I was trying to stay native. So you know, weeks and months of just racking my brains and reading and researching. And I finally came up with a short list and got a Canadian hemlock, which I'm really excited about. Beautiful plant. I've got some native rhododendrons. They are Rhododendron Maximum. You'll see big stands of them in North Carolina on the Blue Ridge, in the Blue Ridge Mountains there. I've got mountain laurel. Oh, and I should mention my husband's request was make it look good in the wintertime, because I've got so many perennials that they all just die back in the winter. And, you know, it looks great in the summertime, but in the winter, everything just goes away. So his request was make it evergreen, and my request was make it native. So we've got that hemlock, we've got the rhododendrons, mountain laurel, Kalmia latifolia. What else? And one thing I'm super excited about, and I wish more people knew about it, was this plant called a needle palm. It's Rapidophyllum hystrix. I'm not going to try and spell it. But it is a hardy palm. Are you familiar with a palmetto?
Yes.
It looks a lot like a palmetto.
Needle palm.
Needle palm. Okay. And it is hardy to -5 degrees Fahrenheit. They are known to grow as far north as Canada. And they make these clumping, so they'll spread underground slowly by suckers. But they're called needle palms because they're around the base. You know, they've got this real typical kind of shaggy trunk like a lot of palms do, but they're these needles that actually stick up out of them. But for evergreen and for interest, you can't beat it. I mean, you can have a tropic in New York State.
Nice. What a concept. How to make your garden look good in the winter.
You know, it's the season that a lot of people overlook, I think, especially if you're like me and you're sort of an amateur do-it-yourself landscaper. You think flowers, you think bushes, you think, how can I make the birds come into my yard? How can I get butterflies here? What can I put in my yard to have like a cutting garden for it to bring flowers in? But in the wintertime, you know, you see a lot of people's houses planted up, and it seems like there's a sort of boilerplate. There's you. There's boxwoods. What's another big one? Just little evergreen things that stay. And they're so overlooked because they're overused. And so my real mission was to find things that were underutilized, to invite people to come ask the question, what is that? You know, because I'm guilty. I will see stuff in people's yards. I'll walk up to their door and I'll knock. What is that? What is that in your backyard that I can see peeking over your fence? And they always kind of like, they open the door crack and they look out and they're like, can I help you? And I'm like, I'm sorry, I'm just the crazy lady walking by. I want to know what that plant is in your backyard. So, and, you know, I want to be a part of a conversation. And I hope that as people are, you know, walking by, even just my neighbors, they'll say, what you got? That's really neat.
I love it. You generally get two responses, like, I don't know, the gardener stuck it there. Or if they're a gardener, it's like, oh, come and let me talk to you.
Yeah. You can almost always tell the gardeners, though. Yeah. I mean, if they've got the oddball plants in there, stuff that you really have to look to find. You can't just go to the big box store and buy it. You have to hunt it down. So those are the places that interest me.
I want to make sure the listeners hear about your blog. It is gorgeous. I see a lot of gardening sites. Tell me a little bit about the inspiration behind plowandfurrow.com.
The name of the blog or the entire
whatever itself. Grabs you, because it's a unique name. It's easy, you know, it makes a lot of sense. And but I think visually, it's visually stunning.
Oh, thank you. Actually, the name was a bit of a point of contention with my husband, because we're only on a quarter acre here. We're quasi-suburban. And he's like, well, you know, we don't have a farm, so we don't have plows and we don't have furrows. And I was like, but it sounds cool. And, you know, eventually I think I would like to have a larger property with, you know, I can do more with it. But, you know, I think the inspiration behind it was really when I garden, you know, I get down in the dirt with my hands. And even though I'm not using machines very often, I'm plowing, you know, I'm definitely digging stuff up. And to have to plant, you have to have a furrow, you have to have a row or a hole or something to put your thing in. And so that was kind of the genesis of that. Plus, it sounds really nice and kind of British.
Yeah, wonderful.
Sort of rustic. I am not British, as you can tell. But, you know, just it had a nice ring. And as far as the blog itself, I've had lots of friends ask, You know, how do I grow this? How do I grow that? How can I get my tomatoes to go? What can I plant on this side of my house? And, you know, I thought, well, if I'm telling you, I might as well write about it because that's my profession. I'm a writer. And I figured I can reach more people that way. So I've had good response from friends and family, and it's still, you know, a little on the unknown side in the greater world, but hopefully that will, you know, the word will spread.
Excellent. I glanced at the clock. Our time is rapidly moving.
Oh, no.
Well, now's the time in the show when we get to play our favorite game called Five Quick Questions.
Uh-oh.
This is your chance to share your knowledge and wisdom with novice gardeners. Are you ready to play?
Uh-huh.
Michelle, question number one. In your opinion, what do you think stops most brand new people from even trying gardening?
I think they think it's going to take a lot of time and talent. That, you know, if you don't have the knack for it, that you will never have the knack for it. And I wanted to tell everyone who thinks they don't have the time or they don't have the knack that it's like learning a language. You practice it, you get better at it. And, you know, the moment you mess with dirt and a seed, you're a gardener. And it doesn't matter what you're growing or how much time you spend doing it, even just, you know, putting a little marigold in a pot, you're a gardener. So don't give up. You know, if you really want to be a gardener, you can be and you will be.
I love it. Question number two. What is the best gardening advice that you've ever received?
Well, I guess, can I do two things?
Oh, you sure can.
Two pieces of gardening.
Well, let me check with
advice.
The judges. Judges, can we get a ruling? Absolutely, you
ding,
can.
Ding, ding. Okay, great. My mother, my source of wisdom, she gave me this rosemary plant once, and it was in this lovely blue pot, and, you know, it was intended to be sort of a portable pet because I was still moving around from apartment to apartment post-college. And she warned me not to overwater it, and she said, you know, it really will thrive on benign neglect. And I have found, you know, in my own gardening adventures that benign neglect is something that has really served me well. Like if you mess with something too much, it's probably going to pout. And of course there are things that are fussier, but don't overdo it. You know, just the plant will take care of itself. It's really, really hard to mess something up. They're tough. So benign neglect. And the other advice I read somewhere once, and I can't remember the source, is that the best pesticide is the gardener's shadow.
I got to write that down.
And it really kind of transformed my outlook on, you know, my role. And especially, I think this really applies more to my vegetable patch because things are a little more susceptible to problems. But just going out and having a look. And, you know, it's like being part of a neighborhood. You know when somebody is new. You know when somebody's just passing through. You know when somebody doesn't belong there. And you go into your garden every day and you'll learn, you know, you're the good guy. You're the bad guy. You, I'm going to keep an eye on and we'll find out. And so you really get to know, like, your local residents when you're in the garden. And, you know, if you have hands-on and you have presence, then most problems really just take care of themselves.
I know you are a writer, Michelle. Have you ever written any fiction?
Fiction? Oh, I think the last time I wrote fiction was in college.
I could just see you writing a series called The Gardener's Shadow. Private eye stuff or something. That's good.
The Garden Mysteries.
Very nice. That's good wisdom. The internet's a big, useful resource for gardeners. Do you have any gardening friends with blogs or any gardening, maybe one or two websites that you can recommend to novice gardeners?
Oh, geez. Well, I mean, there's so many websites, as you know. I guess most of my, as a beginner gardener, a lot of my resources were books, but websites, you know, the Old Farmer's Almanac, don't knock it. It actually has a really great website, and they've got a lot of, it's so comprehensive. You know, you can look up anything about any plant, any vegetable, tips for how to start things, what kind of soil you need to use, what sort of light, water, you know, when you should plant something. So Old Farmer's Almanac, I think, is still really good. And it's, you know, it's a familiar resource to a lot of people, so it's not this kind of out in space reference. And the other thing I try and let people know whenever I can is that here in the United States, every state has what's called a land-grant university. So North Carolina State University. and they will have an agricultural extension department. And those ag extension departments have websites. So it's the University Extension, and they have a lot of resources for crops and vegetable, but also about trees and shrubs and perennials, annuals, exotics. And I've used a lot of them for research for my own gardens and writing. Some of my favorites, like I mentioned a second ago, North Carolina State University, Virginia Tech has a really good one, Cornell, University of California, Davis, Clemson University, and University of Florida. Also, I like Missouri Botanical Garden. Now, they're not a university, but they have, it's a fantastic website. Beautiful pictures. If you are considering a plant and would like to know what it looks like when it's all grown up, and if you can even plant it where you are.
Wonderful. Good stuff. My hand has turned into a claw. I'm ready.
Oh, no.
No, it's good. Well, yeah, and a lot of people, you know, we live in a society that moves around a lot. Never to, you know, oh, that won't grow here. You know, guys are growing bananas. And do you know what zone you are, by the way, Michelle?
We are a zone 6. Some people say 6, like it's almost a 7, but where I'm at is this little pocket of cold weather. So I'm a zone 6.
Oh, wow. Okay, good. I just like it. It's not written in stone, but it's always curious to see what'll grow where.
Yeah. And, you know, microclimates make a big deal too. You know, you can be in a zone 6. But have a protected spot where you can grow zone 7 plants. Mm-hmm. Me, I would like a protected thing like a greenhouse and grow limes. That's what I would like to do. I really want a key lime tree.
My wife's parents, Yaya and Papu, they live in Toronto, and it's sheltered on all 3 sides of the garden, so it's super hot back there. Mm. I saw a squirrel. And I mean, this thing was the size of a coyote. It was a big city squirrel. It went in the garden, grabbed a hot pepper off the plant, started gnawing on it, and ran off with it.
Huh.
And I've never seen a squirrel eat a hot pepper.
So much for hot pepper deterring pests.
Yeah.
No, and it's funny, to get kind of back to the warm zone in, excuse me, in Washington, near the botanical garden, right near the Capitol. There is this outdoor extension to the botanical garden where there's actually a pomegranate tree growing, and it makes fruit every year.
Wow.
Even pomegranates are a zone 8, solid zone 8, but there's one growing in zone 7, I think, and just because of the spot, it just works.
Mm. Yeah, so, don't try this at home, but here we can pull it off.
Yep. Nice. Yep. I mean, and you can always experiment, you know, if you can, you can try with, I guess, low risk things. You get maybe a perennial that's rated a zone below you, and you know your yard or your conditions the best, and stick it someplace where you think it might work. See what happens.
Good. Oh, question number 4. You touched on it. Books.
Books.
A gardening book that you would recommend a novice gardener read, or maybe one of your favorite gardening books.
Oh, geez. Novice gardeners. I mean, really, go to the library and just come out with a pile. Mm-hmm. There's such a good resource, so you don't have to, you know, buy all kinds of books. But a book I'm reading right now is Bringing Nature Home by Doug Tallamy. And he's talking about the importance of private gardens and the role they play in increasing biodiversity and kind of bringing nature back from out there in the woods to in here in our homes, and how we, you know, we play a role in making sure that nature stays healthy and that we are part of nature. So, I'm, as I mentioned before, a big believer in sustainability and conservation. And I do believe that gardens can be both functional and beautiful, you know, for us as well as everything that comes here to visit them.
Wonderful.
Two other authors that I think, you know, if you get into gardening, mm-hmm. Alan Armitage, Michael Durr. Those are two of my heroes.
Nice. I'll put the links in the show notes, folks, so just if you're listening along, don't worry. Though I'm amazed how fast some people can take notes on their phone with their thumbs.
I'm still an old-fashioned pen and paper note taker.
I've written half a page of notes. Number 5. This is a fun one. Look into your crystal ball for next season. Mm. What's the number one thing you would encourage every gardener to try to grow next season?
Oh, I guess the first thing that jumps to mind is milkweed. Are you familiar with the monarch butterfly issue?
We are planting our milkweed 3 weeks from now because Shauna Coronado demanded that I grow some.
Oh, good. Yeah, you know, it grows in ditches here, and the farmers haven't figured out how to spray it yet, so that's nice. But, you know, if every milkweed, the exclusive food of monarch caterpillars, and I don't know, I feel like if everybody just planted even just one plant in their yard, we'd create these corridors for them. You know, if the farms and fields don't have that food source for these butterflies, then we've got to replace it somehow. You know, when I was a kid, we lived in Utah, and we had this little tree. It was probably, I don't know, 15 feet tall. And I remember walking outside the house one day, and you couldn't see the tree because it was covered in monarch butterflies. It was this seething, writhing mass of just orange and black, like absolutely covered. And I've never seen anything like it since. And I think it would be a real shame to, you know, for my kids to not even have the opportunity to see that. And, you know, it wouldn't be the first time something has gone extinct because of something we did, I guess. But it doesn't have to be that way. So milkweed. And if I could also make a recommendation, just go to the nursery and let the plants talk to you and pick up something that just says me and try something new, something weird. Just do an impulse buy and expand your horizons.
I love it. Oh, don't say impulse buy around my wife at a garden center. Are you the same way? Can you walk in? Do you have the willpower?
Well, you know, I have a bit of a budget, so if I go in, I have to know what I'm getting. And one of the reasons why I don't have as many shrubs and trees as I'd like is because perennials are cheaper. And I'm kind of a bargain rack shopper too. Like, I'm not afraid if a plant looks a little sad because I know how to bring them back.
Oh, that's but wonderful.
I've got a couple rescued orchids and a couple rescued perennials out and about my garden, but you know, I try and restrain myself, but when there's a little extra, it's hard to be like, ooh, I'll just take another fern.
It is a wonderful obsession, isn't it?
It's great. It's really wonderful. Yeah,
good. Folks listening, make sure you follow Michelle on Twitter at mzdonahue. Check out her gorgeous website at plowandfurrow.com. Michelle, you've been a brilliant guest.
Thank you.
I'm going to give you the last word today.
Oh, no.
It could be okay. I was just curious, do you have a pearl of wisdom or maybe a note of encouragement for our struggling gardeners out there on their gardening adventures?
Just keep with it. You know, I mean, go out, talk to them, water them, prune them, have faith, and just enjoy the ride. You know, it's a process, and you know, one of the things that I really love about gardening is that it takes you out of the crazy pace that we live our lives with now. And it sets you into this, you know, almost prehistoric timeline where you have to adjust your expectations and learn how to truly be patient. So just watch and wait, and you will be rewarded.
I love it. Michelle, thank you for being on Back to My Garden.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Attention, garden lovers. Do you want to save time, save money, and have your most amazing garden ever? Receive free tips, strategies, and gardening techniques from passionate gardeners around the world. Join the VIP club for free today at www.backtomygarden.com/VIP.